Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Press Fix Podcast, brought to you by the Journo DAO. And we are at episode 5. And if you look at some of the other episodes, you can see that this podcast is about the intersection of Web3 and journalism and ways in which journalists can use Web3 to help their practice. And today, I'm a co-host, Eureka John, or John Miller. And we have Spencer and Eric Mack, all with the Journo DAO here. And we have our guest, Anson Parker, and we'll do a brief round of introductions here and let you get to know us first, and then we'll dive right in.
Yeah, I'm Spencer, also Clinimanic, although I think I just have Spencer displayed here. I'm not a professional journalist, but I've been involved with Journo DAOs for the last couple of years, pretty much since it got off the ground, and I guess I specialize more in terms of the technology side of things and using Web3 for operations and governance, and I'm keen to see how this technology can help make our media landscape a bit healthier.
Hey, yeah, Eric Mack. I spent a career in journalism of all sorts, contributing to a bunch of mainstream outlets from Forbes to NPR, and co-founded Journo DAO with these fine folks here. I'm also now in the public relations department at Consensus, and I live off the grid with my family in northern New Mexico, so looking to decentralize as many things as possible, from energy to the news.
Hi, Anson Parker. I'm here from Charlottesville, Virginia. I work in the UVA Health Sciences Library, doing data science tech support for other researchers, and got involved in Web3 working on civic tech. We're looking at low-income credit scoring in our community, and went from there into kind of governance products, working at Aragon for a while, and now doing a couple of startups, one in legal engineering, LexBlock, and another in a 401k savings product, Athenic. And we're going to try and put in some guardrails to make parts of Web3 useful and compliant. Regulatorily compliant. Yeah, and I think we were, just talking about last night, we had a Web3 meetup, and the thing that came out of it, there was like this NFT wallet platform, and I'm scratching my head because I don't get it. It's just all these products that I never wanted and I don't need. Talk about being attached to a grid, shove another Pokemon at me, do it. And so then, but then all of a sudden, the guys were like, well, no, but we're also making a really auditable company that people can invest in. And I'd been talking to a day trader that morning. It was like, yeah, I'm tracking these Web3 companies because I've got better data, and it's just business. That is nice to hear.
Nice. Yeah, you bring up a good point that there's a lot of different use cases and unexpected use cases in Web3. And just a brief little background about myself, I got involved in the Journo DAO, mainly just doing audiovisual technology. And I come from a Web Zero background, like zero tech. We were using a fax machine at a manufacturing plant. And here I am jumping into something that is the bleeding edge of technology and finding all different types of use cases. You are from a data science and a library science technology background as well. And you mentioned that there are people coming in and you were talking to traders, and that is really how a lot of people get into Web3 and crypto technology, is through day trading and finance, and the finance bros, and number go up and all that stuff. And you're coming at it from the complete opposite end of the spectrum. So tell me a little bit about your background and you coming from that non-finance aspect of it, and how Web3 can be applied to something like library science.
Sure. I mean, I got into civic tech years ago. I think that's where blockchain products like what I think what you guys are doing. I've got a spiel. I'm going to give you a spiel, which is that, like, You know, like I've got one. It's already there. It's like done. But it's like, you know, as a journalist, you're going to be creating more and more content, and like people aren't going to read it, right? Like it's going to get merged into other data sets and, you know, transformed through generative AI into something that's consumable. And that's what should happen, right? Like that's convenient as fuck as a consumer. And that's fine. But like, I think what's exciting is like that, you know, products like Web3 give you canonical data and vectorized databases that give you the AI, give you kind of fractional representation of content. You know, you say, okay, well, how much of a citation did I get from this article? How much of a citation did I get from that article? And so you can all of a sudden actually give those attributions out kind of in a nice way. And the technology is built around that. That's what a vector database is doing. And so building an AI model with JournoDAO product, with journalism product now, it isn't as scary. It's better almost, and we can do better on royalties. And you know, you can, because you'll know, generally speaking, how much to attribute to a different article. And you can quibble over the math a little bit, but it's infinitely better than what's being done right now. And I think having it all tied into a Web3 canonical framework is the linchpin for that. You gotta have it, right? And so like, this is where the blockchain products, that tiny niche where the utility and the technology are right online. So as a librarian, you know, yeah, you're just looking for canonical data. You're like, where, how do I know that that's my data? And then, right, like that, I need to know. And Web3, it's right there. With generative AI, you tie that onto that base layer of Web3 and you can really build great products, I think. And so that it's that, you know, Web3 AI overlap that I think is really exciting.
Oh yeah, when you say that the Web3 could be better than some of the existing practices here, do you think that's attributable? Because you mentioned the day trader mentioning that because it's all publicly auditable, there's just more data that they have access to. Do you think Web3 is better in certain respects than existing practices because the public auditability or because of the peer-to-peer structure of it that makes it difficult for it to be siloed or deprecated?
I don't know if I believe in any, I don't know how much I believe in any of that, right? Like, I think you believe in too much. You're kind of like, you know, I mean, all these products are running on AWS and Google Cloud and, you know, Azure. So I don't know. I think this is why I like Q.org, right? They're backed up by a nation state. You can kind of trust that to a reasonable degree. And I think that's kind of an exciting, again, it's kind of this, where I would hope that more governance gets involved. And sorry, John, back to your original question. You know, I got in because I was looking at low-income credit. Aragon had a multi-sig open source product, started kicking the tires on it. It didn't work quite like it could have. And then, but it gave us voting. It gave you like on-chain voting, which is pretty exciting stuff. And, you know, that governance question gets explored 100 different ways, but yeah, that's how I got involved. And I, you know, I think about 8 years, actually the 8 years ago, I ran for city council, and on the premise of getting rid of city council and having an app, that was a train wreck. I learned all about voter apathy and just got absolutely slaughtered in the elections. So that was my initial kickoff, but yeah, it's always been something that's interesting.
Can you just really briefly explain what Q.org is? I'm just on their website right now. I'm not super familiar with it.
It's really just an Ethereum clone, straight up. It's an Ethereum clone with a token that has no value. I love them for it. Like it is strictly a governance token. The thing's absolutely useless. God bless them. You know, they're just into governance. That's all they work on, and they've got nerds, man. Everybody in that room's a nerd. It's great. Somebody from MIT's AI department's in the room. You're like, yeah, no, I don't talk much over there. I know better. Those guys are, no, it's a really sharp crew. And they're just governance nerds. And they've got a blockchain product. And the government of Liechtenstein, the monarchy of Liechtenstein, whatever, the feudal Lord of Liechtenstein endorses it to some degree. Their government endorses it to a degree. And so I think it is an opportunity to be a model for how governments run and provide auditable data to their citizens. You look at it as a security product. It's going to be more stable than your regular infrastructure, certainly more stable than your traditional database, right? I mean, it's relatively immutable. So I think a lot of it's exciting to see that direction take shape.
Yeah, I wonder, can we go back to the AI thing really quick? Because when you were kind of elucidating the potential value of Web3 for dealing with AI in terms of kind of being able to establish your sourcing and having all that, as you're describing it, and you're talking about journalists and creators will create content and that'll get ingested by AI and then that will respond to our queries, and like that's the way that it should be. And then we have we can go on chain or whatever decentralized system preferably and see the source. This all makes complete sense to me, and I agree with everything you said, but like as a journalist and as a content creator, there's another dimension of it, which I think is the dimension that maybe you're more resistant to than us, which is like I kind of cringe a little bit when it's like, well, you're going to create content, it's going to get ingested by the AI, and then the AI is going to serve everybody. It's like, well, you still kind of need us to create that content, because eventually, eventually you run out of the source material if the people creating the source material aren't properly incentivized. So like, the other dimension of the Web3 stuff that excites me is the ownership and value aspect of it that you can tie to the content. So you have like, I'm personally excited about both of those dimensions. And I know you're like skeptical.
We need a lawyer. I mean, I think you're going to need a lawyer in the room, right? Like that's why I'm in a legal engineering firm, is that, because you're right. Like, and then there are all these requirements, and it's like, well, but there's no fucking delete button there, guys. Like, we can't, we can't unfuck that part of it. It's there. And so I think what ends up happening, and this is that you have to write a contract that like takes that into account. Because you're right, man, like you source that shit up and it gets into a model, it's going to be hard to yank it out, man. It's going to be hard.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. Like, but I think the solution ends up, I believe, just for expediency, the solution ends up being that you license that content for however long you do it. And either the model gets refreshed or, some other mechanism gets pointed out, and that's what you adhere to. I don't know, right? I mean, because, yeah, you're wrong. I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think? I mean, I don't know. It's a tough one. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, in terms of sketching out the mechanics of exactly what model is going to work, I don't really know what it is, but, like, I see the potential for a lot more fairness in the way that Web3 and yes, crypto doles out value and allows for a community to assign value and decide actually what value is and then allocate that value. I just have more faith in that than I do in our incumbent centralized systems.
You should know who's fucking you. Yes, I mean, you may still get fucked, but you should, like, you, right? Yeah. You should get a name along with it, along with that. Yeah,
right.
100%, man. 100%. Maybe somebody else to reach out to would be the guys over at BagelDB. They're interesting. They're doing like a vector database that's on IPFS. They talk about, Eric, I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you, but it's like, but what you're saying, I was like, man, this is tough. It's like, this is, and I think these guys are thinking about some of those questions about how to like pull data back and have snapshot models that you can work off of. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the solutions for the AI apocalypse probably don't come from this room. And like in a way, another thing that's, attractive about, crypto as the counterweight to AI is like we're so far behind. It's like Microsoft has basically swallowed the world already, and now we've got, I mean, there's lawsuits and there's people like launching new products to, and we're working on stuff to like, wait, we have to, like kind of declare our sovereignty over our creations and the value that we've created before it just like gets filtered through OpenAI and like and goes back out to the world, and we just kind of repeat the Google swallowing the world phenomenon that we saw over the last 20 years.
No. I mean, it's happening. We're getting to watch it. I'm fine with it. I mean, I think it's like anything else. You try to get a good open source model, it's really tricky. It is tricky stuff. I see some really good work getting done, and I'm pretty excited. I think in 2 weeks we're going to be having an AI hackathon here. We're working with a couple of nonprofits. We're going to be doing and we've got 1,300 local nonprofits in Central Virginia, so we're going to do a data scrape of all those. And the idea is that, we're going to try and help find alignments. We've got a grants database at the library, and we're going to try to find alignments between the different nonprofits and some of the grants that are available. It's a classification algorithm, and then we're going to try and get some boilerplate. AI, imagine that these three nonprofits are trying to fill out this grant. Help us with some boilerplate. I think it's going to be fine. I think for the kind of work we want to do, the bar is reasonable. I think it's pretty. So I don't know. I see a lot of, there's so much utility in it. You got to figure out how to fit in with it. How to leverage it. Right? It's just so good. Like, that's not
When you say we, which organization is that?
Working with Center for Civic Innovation in Charlottesville, and then the UVA Health Science Library and the School of Data Science and Code for Seville are the
Okay.
groups leading it. The nonprofit we're supporting in this, we actually have a focus group, Girls on the Run.
So are all these organizations working together towards the same goal, or is this?
I mean, I'm a fellow at the Center for Civic Innovation. They fund a lot of my research. They've been really great. They fund a lot of our research and get us giving some office space downtown occasionally. The project that kind of got me, that I'm still hacking away on, is this DeFico product. About 2 years ago we started. I'd never looked at Web3. I didn't take it seriously at all. I mean, it was easy to discredit people. They stood out. They made names for themselves. It's like, but some of the tech ain't bad, and so it does make sense. And so I think, but the thing with that I learned really after a little bit trying to work with low income credit scoring, what it happens, we're looking at like low income housing, and it turns out you need credit scoring for low income housing, blah 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 blah. And so we're like, well, how do you get a credit score? I don't know. I'm a librarian. I don't know shit about money. So we start like figuring out. It's like, oh, you got these three companies that manufacture credit scores, which is adorable. And then
Yeah, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian.
The trifecta of
Yeah, and you always wonder like where they get their information from,
Oh, that
where
just
they get,
and how much that information is worth.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
That's the part that really grinds you, right? Is like, no. And I think as a journalist, right? I mean, again, this gets back to your mission. It's like, no, this data is worth money. Like,
Yes.
this is value. This is context. This explains how things happen. I own that, right?
Okay.
Yeah, that's my money.
As a library, as a library scientist and a data scientist, every single interaction that we have online is churning out data, and we're basically creating food for AI because, AI needs us to create that data to reference what Eric was saying earlier. Like, we are its food. And if we suddenly decide to boycott creating that data, then AI dies without that. So AI has to compensate us in some way, which brings in the financial value of it.
Yeah.
At the very beginning, you said like you were able to, someone were to write an article, and I'm going to try to summarize this. AI could parse that article and find the tidbits that would go down provenance and find the person who created that piece of it. That's all right. Pieced together in an article.
That's how vector databases pretty much work. I mean, that
okay. I don't know anything about vector databases. Sure,
the back end of your LLMs are vector databases. They come in a lot of different shapes and sizes, but generally, instead of storing, you know, an X and Y, they are actually storing kind of the shape of data, you know, and so you're starting to look at, because that's kind of how the data looks, to be honest. Like, there are the relationship of the data, if you start networking it out, it takes on a structure. It's there. And so these vector databases leverage that aspect of the data to find answers and to coordinate answers. And it turns out that you can, and so you're going to see an overlap of like contextual regions when you're answering questions.
Oh.
I guess the point is that you're going to say, like, people are going to be asking questions like of journalists that are like reasonably complicated, right? Like, help me understand the conflict in Gaza, right? Everybody knows that's a really easy one because like the answers are super clear. It's great. And so like when you go to answer these kinds of really easy questions, you're going to get a lot of, you know, it's going to get unpacked, but it's also going to get repackaged. And the answer that comes out, right or wrong, right, should at least be attributable, right? Like, we should at least know where that came from, like who said what and why. And you should be able to tie that back to primary source, right? Like, okay, Here's how I got that answer. And here are my primary sources. That's
and then like, compensate that primary source.
And then compensate that person and have it be, at least know where the sausage came from. Like,
sure,
the hog. And I mean, and that's what I think, that's all that you can offer.
Yeah. Real quickly about the vector databases, you talk about an X and Y coordinate, you know, as in I'm thinking like spreadsheet, but that you add that extra dimension in there of context, almost like a knowledge graph, right? A social graph.
Something like that. Yeah, I think that's a better way to look at it. I mean, it's linked to data. Yes, it's a better way to look at it. Yeah, because it's not just like columns and rows. That's really not how they're storing the content.
It's the World Wide Web.
Right. It's tunnels, man. It's tubes. Series of tubes. No, but there are a bunch of people working in that space. That was just one example off the shelf. Happens to be, connected to IPFS. Yeah. A lot of ways to cook those eggs. Sure. But a lot of people, you know, there's a Zotero app for OpenAI now. There's like all these great apps for like, you know, connecting your citation models into OpenAI and making it something for researchers to use in a reasonably, hopefully a more ethical way. I mean, that is what that's a standard that a lot of people are trying to chase. Actually, while we're talking about this, Rachel Rudinger is doing some really neat work in terms of, I think, this is going to be an interesting, the thing that I think she's doing that's especially interesting is Winograd tests. Yeah, Wino schemas and Winograd tests. And these are, this is kind of neat shit. It's like, how do you detect like the absence of content in a data set? And so, that's some interesting stuff. You know, like there's no rhinoceros behind me, but there could be. Why isn't there? You know, like what is that? And should there be? You know, like the next question. Like, you know, and those kinds of so one of the things I think this is what's kind of exciting also is that you could start looking at like, well, what context is missing in the discussion of some question, and that's what Rachel Rudinger is doing. And she's creating these Winograd tests where they try to detect the absence of something in a question. And that's pretty exciting, I think, also, like in terms of like relatively leading edge thoughtfulness. Yeah. In the space, the
absence of something that should be there, but yeah, you'd have to analyze all situations on what should be there in all situations.
Yeah,
no, a lot of data.
Well, she started out, I think, doing some questions. Somebody was doing questions about why they couldn't find Chinese people or in railroad photos, I think it was. You know, it's like, where are they? You know, like, what happened here? What's going on? And then they explored some of those questions, and I may have that story completely backwards. Fact check that. But it was interesting. They were like really digging into these visual histories and trying to figure out what was like, why are we missing this piece of information?
Are these tests intended to be applied to content or databases where we suspect the author or some kind of some authority like intentionally omitted important information or censored certain information?
Yeah.
That's exactly where my brain went too. Cause I mean, in the context of journalism and media, you know, it's not whenever there is an argument around a certain topic, like say Gaza, like it's never about what the people in the argument are. It's not about the points they're making and the counterpoints. It is about the points and the data that they are leaving out. Like that is always the most important part of any debate. That is fascinating. So, I mean, is there a semantic, is her work, you said she's working on it visually. Is there like a semantic dimension?
Yeah. Dude, she's baller. Where is Soda Pop, I think, is her open-ended discovery of social biases and social common sense reasoning models was one of her recent products. It's all over the place. I think, you know, I mean, for people who are interested in like trying to, you know, suss out, you know, like, I mean, oh man, I mean, it's going to be brutal, but it's going to be funny as hell. Like I work in a library, man. Do you want to bet how many of our archival exhibits have to do with white dudes? I'm going to go with all of them, you know, like maybe all of them, maybe not all of them, but maybe all of them, you know, and like, well, why is that? Like, what else is going on here? Like, are there any other stories? Like, and I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it's true. You know, it's like, and it's interesting, you know, it's like, I think it's going to be an interesting time.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of tons and tons of different theories going around about like advanced civilizations, even like less than 100 years ago, and Tartarian civilizations and great floods, just about, you know, like half our world is underneath a mud flood and all this other type of stuff you see all over Twitter every single day. And a good analysis of that sort and then letting AI parse it could be a very good way to help spot any type of revisionist history. And I could, you know, it could debunk conspiracy theorists in that way, or it could reinforce some things too, you know.
It'll be interesting. These are leading edge people who are like, who I'm like visiting, you know, 5-8 years after they started doing their work. I mean, 10
yeah,
years ago, I mean, the research is interesting, and I'd love to hear more. You know, I ask around, but I don't. Who else? You know, there's a bunch of people on it. It seems like we'll see.
It could definitely help rein in a lot of the stuff that's going on. You know,
and I feel like it could.
Yeah,
I agree. No, I feel like that's right. Like, I think it's like you could have it. You know, calling bullshit pretty quick, and that could be very. And doing it thoughtfully, you know, like that's, I think, the other thing, you know, like my sister is all involved in like, you know, trying to like have normalized discussions about conflict and shit. Mm-hmm. And it's like, right, no, you can de-escalate. You can have AI de-escalated things.
Do it in a tasteful manner.
right. You don't have to go right. No,
I did have a question for you about, you mentioned earlier that, at least as I interpreted it, some kind of need for canonical data structures for library scientists. And as someone who isn't a data scientist or a library scientist, I am curious about this one method. Someone just let me know about resource description framework, RDF. I was just talking about this with someone else and how, at least as I understand it, that it's more of like a method of structuring data rather than a particular platform or
RDF. RDF is just an XML derivative. It's been around for ages, and it's a good thing. It means you can have linked data structures, and so you know you can have a schema, and you know that you can declare much like our attestations that we that you and I both that we all love here. Right, RDF is an opportunity to use a schema. That's it, and yeah, no, it's very useful.
Because what interested me about this was like you just made the attestation connection there, and what JournoDAO is working on. For anyone who isn't familiar, give a little spiel on that. We're working on a project called PermaPress. One of the other JournoDAO founders, Keith Axline, is the developer for that, and we're working on an MVP right now. And it's essentially like a publishing or meta publishing and indexing tool for journalists in particular, but content creators in general, to publish some article that they did or some arbitrary piece of content to some storage layer. Could be decentralized, could be centralized, and then also deploy all of these little metadata parameters or field or properties about that content onto Ethereum or some other blockchain using attestations. And a lot of the work we've been doing on this has been conceptual work for how do we structure those schemas and how do we structure how those little bits of data relate to one another, because we're sort of talking about an on-chain semantic web, which this idea of the semantic web. And I think this RDF could be an interesting sort of logic to adopt there in terms of how these pieces of content relate to one another.
We should all be, this is a rant, but I mean it. We should all be using Wikidata or something like that. We should not be redeveloping schema management. Schema management has been like sussed out. It is working fine. We need to contribute to that. Like, we should not be reinventing any of that. The underlying architecture that you choose to leverage your schema in, that's between you and your gods, man. Somebody's going to tell you to do it in Polygon. Somebody's going to tell you to do it in fucking, I might be an Apache Kafka fan. It's all immutable data structures, and it doesn't matter, right? S3 buckets are relatively immutable, right? All of these things are true. And how you get to an immutable structure is that's a religious war. But it should be reasonably, you should be thinking about it. It should be on your menu. Schema management, it should be done in Wikidata. That's what it's for. It is absolutely robust. It can handle millions of inputs. It is as complete a schema management tool as you are going to find. They have thought through these questions. And to the extent that anyone is going to organize and provide quality control on your end product, there's no better community that's already established that will grind it out. These people are weird. They're not well. I don't think they go to they don't have therapy, man. Like, I don't know what's wrong with them, man. But they work on Wikidata the way it's like their model train, man. Like, I don't know what to tell you, man. There's some dudes that are just and they will get your schema organized properly so that it ties into whatever journalistic standards, ISO standards. All of that crap can be coordinated, and you can have a single point of truth that then you can, really flesh out for each region that you're in. I mean, right? When I start thinking about payment gateways and crap like that, right? What you're also ultimately trying to build in is instant, tax payments. You want proof of taxation on the transaction, and that gets into some really complex questions. Where, which tax, whose tax, all that crap, insurance, whose insurance, what, where, all of that you want to be able to discuss baking in, and you really need something that just does schema, and that's Wikidata. And that's a very librarian product, but there's a reason, it does a job.
So I'm fairly ignorant of Wikidata and its nuts and bolts. So my question would be, can that system you're describing, can that be ported into a new environment, like the environment that we've been working in, which is that can be ported into Arweave, but it doesn't have to run through the Wikidata architecture, which I'm assuming they're using like AWS.
No. You're not going through their architecture at all. You're describing your schema. And then you put it into whatever product you choose, but you get the schema hashed out in an environment that's built around schema management. Like attestations are the end product after you figure out your schema. Then you then you create an attestation product that you leverage in Web3 land, and you're done, right? Like that's, but in terms of developing the schema that you're going to put into an attestation, because an attestation schema is a fairly fixed product. Like that's a snapshot, right? Like when you pull the trigger and you publish your attestation schema, it's on chain, you're done, right? That's not really a dev cycle. that's an end product. It's a great end product, but that's an end product. And for the development, I'm saying, I think that's Wikidata, because then you can fight over somebody is going to fight you for it. Like, you do not get to put that lister in there. That is not correlated. It'll make you a little bit mad, but you're also really grateful because, like, nobody else is going to call you out on it, you know?
are you aware of any teams in Web3 world that are already working with Wikidata?
I don't know, man. I mean, I've been putting data in there. I've been putting some structures in there. I mean, it's like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, are there economists that use Wikidata? Yes. Are there, there's some journalists, I would imagine, that have used Wikidata. There are definitely scholars that are in there. I don't know how many scholars have I met that many scholars in Web3? I mean, really? No, it's a nerdy spot.
Charles Hoskinson would be offended.
I mean, there are some, but that's the great thing about it. I think the signal to noise ratio is, such that you can kind of like actually find people who are doing pretty relevant work pretty quickly. Like you cut out the hype and it's like, well, who's left? Okay. It's the room gets real small. You start seeing the same faces. You're like, oh, hey, how's it going? Yeah, no, I think that's one of the things I like.
So I do have a question about Wikidata and RDF, but I guess I first wanted to take a step back and provide a bit of context for anyone listening as to why we're so concerned with all this stuff for JournoDAO and with PermaPress and this idea of being able to attribute authorship and provenance to content so that it can be monetized and people can get credit and get value that they generate through all this. And so much of that is how you're able to access and analyze data and content and how it can be broken down and who has access to it. And I think the big reason we're so into peer-to-peer stuff is that it's, you know, a lot of times you can liken it to digital public infrastructure and that it's not gatekept. You don't have to necessarily pay to access stuff. You can still go about it other ways, but what we're talking about would be public, you know, a piece of content would have all of its data properties broken up in ways that anyone can query and analyze and see, oh, when this person posted this. And so I think that's what we're trying to facilitate with PermaPress and allowing content creators, again, with a focus on journalists, to use this in a way that they don't have to worry about their content, you know, going down with some publication's private data storage solution. And they can publish it in a way where everyone can see they published this piece of content at this time. And I think that's at least why we're concerned with all these really nerdy questions. But the question I had for you was, again, I'm still new to understanding Wikidata and RDF, but are these like competing methods for structuring data? Or are they different, doing different things?
I wouldn't say they're competing at all, and export. Yeah, you can get RDF right out of Wikidata. Yeah, you can export straight to RDF from Wikidata. No. They're the same thing. Yeah, no. That's when you started talking about RDF. I just started talking about Wikidata because it's just kind of it's a user interface and a community built around RDF.
Okay.
No, you're on the right path. That's straight, man.
There could be ways to at least, as I'm starting to understand how RDF works. There's this kind. It's almost like a grammatical kind of syntax where there's some kind of object and its relation to another object, and how that. Do you think that's like a fair sort of primitive way of describing it, and how that's like the way Keith is talking about structuring everything for PermaPress is really atomic, unopinionated ways of parsing all this stuff out. And it seems like we could maybe apply RDF to what we're doing with PermaPress, but I could be misunderstanding it.
Yeah, no, it's just metadata, man. And that in that context, it's just metadata. That's all it is. It's just and but it's contextualized metadata, right? It's metadata that you like add, you know, other layers of context to, so that you can really be descriptive about your content. That's all it is, man. You know, because different words have different meanings in different places and to different people. Everybody has to be able to explain themselves however they want to. And so you need a framework that's really thoughtful about that. And, you know, I mean, like to a pretty, you know, reasonable extent. Now they will, you know, people will hash down your ideas and be like, is it actually that or is it that? Or could these two things be the same? You know, like that, those kinds of questions are going to get asked, as they should, by a thoughtful community that's like used to looking at these kinds of questions. You know, I don't spend that much time in there, man. It is not like, not, I'm not an archivist, man. You know, like I work in library sciences and I support a lot of people, but I'm not creating accession records. I'm not doing the linear feat of archiving every day and like doing this kind of like really detailed descriptive work.
I was doing some researching a while ago on, you know, the difference between Web 3.0 and Web 3. You know, and Web 3.0 was a term that Tim Berners-Lee coined, and he's the inventor of the semantic web. And he said, we're bringing in Web 3.0, not Web 3. And he doesn't want to use any tokens, no blockchain. And he's using something called pods in his project called Solid. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with.
Not at all. Thanks for bringing it up. Yeah. No, this is thanks for bringing this up. Yeah, no, I like everything I'm seeing in here. And Tim Berners-Lee is, thanks for bringing this up. I hadn't seen it. It looks freaking awesome.
Well, he tried to bring in the idea of Web 3.0 back when Web 2.0 was coming into play, but Web 2.0 kind of got siloed into, you know, all these corporations owning your data, and he wants to bring it back to the point of Web 1.0 where, you know, we all own our own data, you know, where everything's decentralized, but he's not using blockchain to do it. And so I guess that begs the question, do we need blockchain or tokens or some kind of currency in there to do this?
Is Solid interested in the ownership question, or is it more about getting the information out of the walled gardens? Is he actually specifically interested in ownership?
It looks like it. I'm just going through their solidproject.org site, and it's, you know, they're running you're running your own server, right? And so they've got it going in Node and Web Components app. So yeah, you're running your own data and you're contributing to a model through your own, through probably some sort of like Git product in the center. But yeah, no, it looks like the content.
Cool. Yeah, I'm not familiar with Solid either, so I would need to look into it to see if there's any.
Yeah, I didn't mean to just throw a wrench in there on that.
Yeah.
But you guys are talking about RDF, and I guess a lot of people might not know what the RDF is, and it's directly linked to this whole idea of the semantic web. And it's like a standard, RDF are like standards that promote common data formats and exchange protocols, right?
Yeah. That's all. Yeah.
Yeah. And just providing that contextual data. So, and which inherently brings in the whole idea of a semantic web.
Yeah. No, that's the, yeah. And so this is just the ownership part. It's really cool though. I've liked his criticism of most of the blockchain products, and I don't know. We'll see where the incentive models land. I'm not an economist either.
Yeah, but you're a library scientist, and you collate and organize data, right?
I haven't correlated. I haven't collated a lot of financial data, and I don't know where. Yeah. I don't know where that lands. You know, I trust somebody else is going to hammer that out. A little bit harder. I'd like to believe you don't need blockchains for very much. I think they're
Well, I mean, it helps to incentivize and compensate journalists. And what about the other people who've played a part in all the cog and the gears, you know, in order to make this happen? Right.
But can you do that? Do you need a blockchain product for payment railing?
Rails?
I don't know. Like I Plaid works really nicely. You know, like I don't know. Like, would I take a digital dollar? Probably would, man. I'm pretty sure. you know, throw it right over there.
Dollars a dollar.
Magic internet money.
Hey, man, I'm not going to be that grumpy, dude. Like, I don't know how to tell you. Like, business, yeah.
I mean, I'm curious what do you all think about this in terms of what value Web3 actually does bring to this? If we're clearly saying that there's all of these other, you know, canonical ways of structuring data and going about ownership in other ways, perhaps the way that blockchain adds value is just as a permissionless settlement layer that isn't institutionally gatekept. I think that's where my mind goes. If you're worried about censorship or stuff like that, which most people really aren't, so I feel like that's something where people that are advocating Web3 and blockchain are constantly advocating for stuff that really doesn't concern most people. But perhaps in certain journalistic edge cases that can be valuable. I mean, that's at least what I think of as like the base value add is just permissionless financial settlement layer. And then the rest of the bells and whistles may not be as necessary. You know?
I mean, it's a whole other podcast, man. And you know, I think we could refer to some previous press fix episodes. I think journalism is the current business model is broken, and I think the information environment is broken, and I will not promise you that blockchain is what is going to fix it, but it is one of the worthiest experiments currently out there, you know, enough so that I've like, you know, shifted my career to work on that. So yeah, no guarantees, but you know, in terms of like why we have to have this token and why there has to be this financialization aspect to it, I agree, it brings in a lot of cringy stuff and a lot of a lot of garbage, but you know, it is it provides decentralized community-based security for the system and community governance for the system, and those are like some really unique and valuable attributes that I don't see in the incumbent systems, which is essentially corporate and privately owned. That's like the minimum value add, I think.
I agree. And to echo that a little bit, I mean, like the day traders in it, to circle around, I got a guy, but the day traders I talked to the other day, you know, they just liked it because they had better access to understand better businesses. And so if what you're trying to do is produce an ethical, you know, business and do a great job, then it's an opportunity, right? Like, what could be kind of cringy and annoying could also be really valuable and an opportunity to make more money, because you can say, hey, here's how I'm doing my business. This makes sense as an investment. This, you know, should get me a loan. This should get me these other financial products that I deserve, because here's how I run my business. And so that makes sense, right? It seems a lot more convenient than the existing infrastructure. Yeah.
Hey, so one thing, to completely shift gears and back up a little bit, I'm like super interested in the roadmap for DeFico, because man, like, that, if there's like one thing that we're aligned on in terms of like that, those credit bureaus are just like the perfect example of like of centralization that does nobody a service except for the people who need it most.
Well, here. The last thing I want to show then, are any of you going to ETH Denver?
Yeah, we all are.
All right. Well, then you should consider yourselves invited. We have rented out a glass studio in Denver for 2 days, the 29th and the 1st. We're going to be at the Furnace. Let me see if I can. We're not live yet, but we will be live fairly soon. So we'll be there.
Glass and legal advice.
We've got it's going to be LexBlock and Q.org will be there. And I think Endowment is maybe going to be there, and MyDAO, and a bunch of other DAOs, and a bunch of other folks. And we're going to make, hold on, wait for it, Glass Blocks. I'm really.
Oh, rad.
Oh, come on. These are adorable, yeah. Right? So, yeah. Now, so you're going to be able to rock. And I've got this plastic gold chain outside. I'm very pleased with as well. And so we'll have plastic gold chains and hand-blown glass blocks. I know. I'm pretty excited about this. So you're all invited. It should be we're actually getting pretty good response from the glass folks are like in for it, man. I'm like, oh, we're gonna have a glass now, guys. Like, I'm actually being kind of like, I'm going totally degen on the glass side. I'm like, fuck it.
Long glass. Yeah. Glass.
Absolutely. No. We're working on NFTs for the glass. I mean, the thing is, glass breaks. I mean, like, that's what it does, man. Like, it is a fragile, fucking ephemeral product. And so, no. It's like, no, this is garbage, man. It's gonna break off soon. Like, the clock is ticking. So we're gonna produce
glass NFT. Break. Glass breaks. NFTs are forever.
NFTs, yeah. Baby. Yeah, you keep the NFT forever.
There's the slogan.
Yeah.
I'm looking at this DeFiCo website, and I know you got to go, but I love the whole part at the bottom. Credit is a right. We deserve access to models that explain the mechanisms of credit. And current credit scores, such as Equifax, TransUnion, and Experium, all fail on timeliness, clarity, and business process regimen. So I love this project. So you want to tell people how they can get involved? And
sure. I mean, I think right now, we are been working with Rain Cards. We've got a dashboard going out of the API. The next really big step is a really big step. Actually, it's pretty interesting shit. The next step is that we can assert credit scores. You know, anybody can do that. It's rad. Yeah, I can say whatever the fuck I want. it's really fun. Do it all the time. But then to make that useful, somebody has to insure it. Insurance is an interesting product. And I didn't know anything about insurance a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, but I know more about it now. And one of the products that is called captive insurance. And so it's like 401k, but for insurance. And it's traditionally used by gajillionaires to insure against, like, it has to be something that happens randomly and that costs you money and that you can insure against. And so you can insure, and then up to about $5 million can be set aside into an interest-bearing account that's there for your insurance. What are you insuring? Oh, what if it rains and I'm like golfing? You know, like, that's gonna cost me like therapy time. I mean, you know, my all these things cost money, man. You know, that's business lost, all these opportunities. And so then you pull out of your insurance money, and then you're milking that, you know, you throw another couple million back in. You go down to the Caymans for 2 weeks and you file your paperwork. You come back and you milk it again. It's great. And that's called a captive insurance plan. And it's 831B on the IRS scheduling. And what we need to do, though, the next big piece for me is I need money. I need to put money into an insurance product. I'd like to have, personally, I'd like to try out this Marshall Island DAO product. Seems pretty interesting. I think they've done a pretty good job. You know, my DAO is going to be one of the sponsors at this product, this party. And what I'd like to be able to do is raise money, because you don't have to just insure against like it raining on your sneakers. Like you can insure against somebody not paying their rent. Adam Thriller Miller, exactly. Yeah. And so the idea is that, yeah, you should be able to insure against not making rent, and that the insurance fund could handle that. And so that's the next big step. And it's not cheap. I like to find, you know, I think 2 to 5 million is kind of actually what you need to do to have a stable fund to insure against a renter's score, you know, which is really what you need to build so that it has utility.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, that's the, so yeah, the actually, and the event, you know, there's no cost to come, but the event will be supporting the Action Center in Denver. So the Glass Shop hooked us up. We're coordinating through them. And this is kind of an immediate need, you know, like you need food or you need something spot, and they provide immediate assistance. So we're going to be accepting donations for those guys, and yeah, working. That's kind of the endowment piece of it.
Well, okay. You know, I think we're all long Web3, but like we're even longer on people that use the concepts to build shit that actually does stuff in the real world and actually matters. So like, I really salute you for identifying this need that is on the surface, not the sexiest need, but like an actual real one, and like building something that like really makes things better. So cheers.
Thanks. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, no, it's a project, man. You know. But I think we've identified, you know, we've got great partners. You know, Rain Cards lets us issue credit cards. We've been working with the I think I've got one right here now. I've got the my Rain card, so I can issue, you know, credit cards off of USDC, which is kind of helpful. And then do I have my community card? Yeah, I do. So now we've got working with the UVA library system, we now have these community cards that we can issue at libraries, and they don't require paperwork. They don't require, you know, anything. They're all based off of proof of you're in Charlottesville and I know who you are. Like, it is, and that's, I think, what I like about it a lot, is that there's no, like, there is no Web3 component to this, thank God. You know, that's like one of the big things I learned about on-chain credit, is that like it's like, you know, you're not able to delete a bad credit score off it on chain. So it's really, it's liability, it's a danger, and you don't want to endanger people. So this gets us out of that. UVA maintains a database, but it's just, hey, all right, yeah, here's your new card. We'll update you in the system. See you. Have a nice day. And it's a public service. It's free. And we can bootstrap off of this now. What's great about this is that the library will give you 20 of these cards. They'll give you 100 of these cards, and we can go down to the local homeless shelter and hand out these cards, and we can then talk about loading them up, which is pretty fucking cool. So things are going well, but we are getting close to the kind of like, well, but we need money now. So that's, not, you know, like, yeah, you know, like the wheels go, yeah, all right, guys. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And we're going to wrap it up here. And that seemed like a good final thought, but do you have any final thoughts beyond that final thought? Or?
No, it's really nice to meet you guys. All right, good to see you all again. Sorry.
Yeah.
No, it's good to see everybody. And I hope to see you in Denver.
Yeah, we're all looking for the truth, and we're all looking to be able to make money to support our projects for the common good. Do we need blockchain to do that? That's debatable. And we have shown today that, you know, we will scrutinize our own possible biases towards going the blockchain and Web3 route as a DAO in Web3. So, you know, we appreciate you, you know, answering our questions, challenging us in a lot of ways. I feel really challenged. Yeah. So thanks so much. And what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Anything technical, really, just Anson, A-N-S-O-N, at virginia.edu.
Okay.
In the space, anything that's going on here, I'm sure it'll be interesting from that. You know, that's where I'd like to keep it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Any last minute things from you guys, Spencer, Eric?
Long glass.
Yeah, long glass.
I don't know, man. I really do want to hit him with it. Like, I do want to hit him with a dial idea. I do. There are some opportunities there. We'll talk about that in Denver. Please do come. I would love for you guys to be there. It'll be a blast. Plus, we can talk shit and make some blast. We'll be right back.